a podcast from the British Postal Museum and Archive.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming this evening. As he mentioned, yes, my name's Aaron. I'm the head of historical interpretation from Warwick Castle. Has anyone been to Warwick Castle, incidentally? Before? Yes. A few guests might have been. So Warwick, right in the heart of the Midlands. It is a very old castle. It's kind of a foundation date to go back to 914, so it's a very, very long history. I myself am actually a specialist. My kind of area of interest is actually the 20th century, so I'm kind of just about tipping into the field of Warwick Castle. And one of the great challenges, of course, is being the historical interpretation leader of Warwick Castle is I'm expected to be an expert on 1,000 years of history, which is sometimes quite a challenge. But it's quite great for me because the really great thing about Warwick Castle is that when you think Warwick Castle, of course, you think medieval, and you think of the Earls of Warwick, maybe even Warwick the Kingmaker and the War of the Roses as a particularly important period, and often the only important period of Warwick's history. And because of that, then there's a whole open field to lots of other areas around that where academics and historians and even kind of interest amongst the public tend to be missed. And so there's a lot of great opportunities to delve into our archives and our research to try and discover many brand new things. And this is one of those particular topics. So just to kind of give you a bit of background about how this kind of study of Antonine came about. I myself am not a particular specialist on the First World War. My particular area of interest is the interwar years, so the 1920s and 30s and the aristocracy. And looking specifically really at how the changes in that period affected the aristocracy as a whole, particularly the Earls of Warwick and Warwick Castle, and that kind of great shift between being the great landowners, the great patrician politicians, into the kind of post-Second World War world where they almost disappeared from the landscape, it seems, and kind of were confined to kind of country houses, and how that kind of great shift took place. And of course, the war is very important in that, and particularly the aristocratic experience of that war, and what it did for the aristocracy, and particularly to Warwick Castle. The reasons I think this is a particularly important topic, there are three reasons why I think the study of Antonine and the study of the First World War in particular is quite important. Firstly is that reason, you know, Warwick Castle, if any of you have been to Warwick Castle and any of you have visited, when guests go there, the assumption is when you get there is that Warwick Castle City really ends in the late 19th century. You know, there is nothing that happens after the kind of 1890s where the kind of scandalous Countess Daisy holds her famous weekend parties with the Marlborough House set, and then snap, you're in 2015. You know, there kind of is a big breach of history there, which is largely unexplored and not told to visitors, which is then what I'm kind of trying to kind of refill in particular. But also actually the aristocratic experience of war itself. I think when we think of the First World War, and particularly now with the kind of centenary in the midst as we are, we're particularly kind of democratized today about kind of what we think of the war. You know, there's a lot of research and a lot of study and a lot of kind of agency given to those groups which in previous wars would have been unheard and not really spoken about, you know, kind of working class communities, kind of rural and urban populations, prisoners of war, colonials, and the home front as well. You know, there's a lot of agency given to, you know, what we know as the People's War, which is absolutely right, of course. But within that then, often you lose that kind of aristocratic voice, and the kind of the experience of the aristocracy in the war is often untold, and it tends to be confined to these kind of country house exhibitions, which again, a lot of you might have visited over the last few years. You know, a lot of country houses having exhibitions about the First World War, about their families and what they did. And one of my kind of worries about that is that the kind of country house exhibitions tends to kind of glamorise and glorify the aristocracy in the First World War. You know, they're painted as these great heroic leaders who led the army, sacrificed their lives and kind of gave everything they could for the noble cause of war, without kind of really investigating what actually was the aristocratic experience. You know, that's the kind of memory we these country houses like to have of their families and of that war, but actually what was their experience, and you tend to lose that a lot in these exhibitions. The third reason, though, this is quite interesting for me, is actually the subject in question. That, of course, is Antony Eden, who, again, I imagine a lot of you will know of and know about his later career, should we say, from the Second World War onwards. And there's some really kind of fantastic work that's been done into Antonida and his life. There's some great books by James, Carlton, Thorpe and Dutton, particularly. Those kind of four historians have written amazing biographies about him. But when kind of studying Antonida's experience of the First World War, a lot of these kind of academics, and it's almost quite natural, is you tend to look at it within the scope of his entire career and looking at Antonida when he was, his kind of activities as Churchill's right-hand man and the Suez Crisis and his kind of premiership. These historians are really looking at the First World War to try and find clues about how his later experiences developed, and you know, is there evidence from the First World War about why he made certain decisions in the 30s, 40s and 50s, without really ever looking at Antonida as a soldier, as a captain in the First World War, and what was his experience, and what does that tell us about the aristocracy at that time particularly. So I think for that reason it's also quite interesting to try and look at this as a particular point in time. The real kind of theme, I guess, that runs through a lot of study of this is this idea of a noble war, which tends to be quite a common theme when thinking of the aristocracy. Proportionally, the aristocracy did suffer more losses than any other class in the First World War. I think it was 20% of the aristocratic sons who and fathers and uncles who went to the war did not come back. And certainly, at the time, you know, as members of the aristocracy, there was a lot of kind of written memoirs, written diaries and published articles by contemporary writers, by aristocrats themselves and later historians, which kind of look at the First World War, therefore, as a great apocalypse for the aristocracy. You know, this is the watershed moment where that kind of great image of the great leaders, the born to lead at the top, it all collapsed away and it all disappeared, you know, from the First World War onwards. There's some kind of really kind of interesting quotes that some aristocrats made. Lady Curzon wrote that, you know, England truly lost the flower of her young men in those terrible days of the First World War. Alan Lascelles, who was the private secretary for Edward VIII, I believe, you know, he said, even though you win a war, you cannot forget that you have lost a generation. You know, the lost generation seems to be a recurring theme, isn't it, throughout the First World War and particularly surrounding the aristocracy. And there was a lot of, in the 20s and 30s particularly, a lot of writings and articles that were published which kind of looks at the kind of great vanishing of the great leaders in blood and fire in the First World War. And I think one of the reasons is that the aristocracy really clung, it seems to begin with, to this idea of a noble cause. You know, the aristocracy as a class had really been under threat for quite a long time, since probably the mid to late 19th century. You know, the rise of socialism had kind of really damaged the legitimacy of the aristocracy. Irish Home Rule had split what was a very secure class into lots of different fractions. There was a great economic depression, which had really reduced that kind of wealth and economic wealth and power that the aristocracy had. And David Lloyd George, of course, you know, in his great crusade against the aristocracy in the early 20th century with his kind of root of the House of Lords, which of course is quite interesting at the moment with what's going on in the news and kind of really putting heavy taxes. You know, the aristocracy had really been under threat for a long time. And what a lot of historians think is that once the kind of First World War was declared, you know, war was declared on Germany, that suddenly the aristocracy found that way back in, you know, a way of proving their use. You know, that we may not be the great politicians anymore, we may not be the great kind of landowners anymore, but what we are is we are the great military leaders. You know, we're going to take up that hereditary task of leading the British army into battle and kind of taking up that noble cause. And as I said, it was that kind of great opportunity to prove their worth and prove their privilege and their wealth and their existence still mattered and was still relevant. I think one kind of individual, one particular quote, which is referenced quite a lot when thinking of the aristocracy in the First World War and this idea of a noble cause and it being a great adventure for the aristocracy, was this guy Julian Grenfell, who was the one of the younger sons of the Baron and Baroness of Desborough, and he essentially says, you know, when writing back to his family, he said, "I adore war. It's like a big picnic, but without the objectivelessness of a picnic. I've never been more well or more happy." And it's often cited that this is that image of an aristocracy going out on this great adventure into battle. It was about having a purpose, having something to do, and proving their might and essentially they went into battle, you know, steaming ahead like lions, but ended up being slaughtered like lions, you know, in this great sacrifice that they were making that decision to go to war, and they lost their lives, and it was a great noble cause that went behind that. And ideas of kind of chivalry and honour and duty were quite significant in the kind of telling of this story amongst the aristocracy. A lot of posters at the beginning of the kind of First World War really tried to kind of encapsulate this image of the heroic knights going into battle. You know, the image of Britannia clad in armour with her swords. A quite bizarre poster with St. George kind of spearing a dragon as well was seen as an image that, you know, would conjure up you know, the middle and elite classes to going into battle and to most significantly volunteering to go to battle, particularly. But this idea of a noble cause, a noble battle, a noble war, and the kind of chivalrous image that, you know, the aristocracy was supposed to embody, really began to collapse as the kind of war went on. First of all, this kind of propaganda is completely void of any sense of blood or destruction. You know, this is about, you know, you don't see, apart from, you know, the one-to-one battle of George slaying a dragon, you know, which isn't that brutal when you look at it, you know, he's simply stabbing it and it's falling down dead. There's no suggestion here of any sense of the destruction that was the industrial kind of age of warfare, and also the letting of blood on a mass scale. And so once those kind of stories of the horrors of war came back, and then this idea of chivalry really began to collapse. It also was relying on self-sacrifice, and of course by 1915, you know, the British government had kind of made that decision to actually conscript an army and actually demand men to go to the front. So even the idea of kind of a noble cause, men going into battle for self-sacrifice themselves essentially, had really kind of saturated, you know, it kind of hadn't worked that well. And noble war kind of really didn't survive that culturally very long into the war. As a whole, as a kind of national culture, as a whole. But it is assumed that the aristocracy retained that. You know, the aristocracy as a class were the one class that retained that idea of a noble cause, a noble battle, that it is worth the fight all the way through. And while the idea of a noble cause, a noble war is, you know, quite significant to, you know, maybe understand why the aristocracy was so determined to go to war and why so many of them did sign up and volunteer, it's not necessarily a key reason why so many did survive. You know, okay, 20% did die in war, and you know, these 20% may have been these great chivalrous knights in their minds who jumped straight over the top and then were kind of gunned down like lambs. But 80% of the aristocracy did survive, you know, and can we assume that, you know, the 4 out of 5 kind of aristocrats that were on the front line, did they all survive without breaking this image of a noble cause, a noble war, all the way through? And that's kind of where, for me, Antoniden comes in, particularly. And kind of looking through kind of Antoniden's letters, particularly that he wrote while on the front line to his family, really showed that this kind of idealism of the noble cause, a noble war, was really undermined by the kind of brutalization of the front line. And really kind of broke down that kind of structured belief in what they were fighting for. And that's kind of hopefully what we'll kind of go through tonight is just a few bits of evidence from within those letters which show that actually this idea of a kind of chivalrous war, a noble battle of these great men self-sacrificing themselves, didn't really survive as the war went on. In actual fact, for members of the aristocracy, like Antoniden, to survive, they had to have completely abandoned that kind of chivalrous code which they might have had at the beginning of the war, in order to survive, in order to manage the kind of psychological difficulties of kind of killing in battle. So just a bit about Antoniden himself then. So Antoniden was born in 1897. He was kind of considered a member of that kind of golden generation of aristocrats. He was a similar age to the two young princes, the future Edward VIII and George VI. And as I said, was kind of seen as the kind of generation that would lead the British Empire, would lead the British nation into the glory of the 20th century, as they might have believed at the end of the 19th century. The Edens themselves, so this is Antoniden's family. Antoniden is the guy on your far right-hand side in his kind of teenage years, with his parents in the middle and his three brothers and sister around them. The Edams themselves were members of the aristocracy, but not a particularly prominent family within the aristocracy. Harold Macmillan termed them essentially the downright regulars. Essentially, they were in a minor aristocratic family. They had wealth, they had land, they had an 8,000 acre estate, Widdowston Hall, which is up in Durham, I believe. And their title had been in the family since the kind of 1670s, but they never really had the power or wealth or land in it to enable themselves to kind of move up the ranks within the aristocracy. But they were very well connected, the Edens. His father was a great art collector, used to purchase lots of art, and so kind of got within the kind of cultural spheres of the aristocracy. His mother was related to Sir Edward Grey, who was the Foreign Secretary, I believe, at the beginning of the war, so were quite well connected politically as well. And also, obviously, his sister married into the Warwick family, which I'll talk about in a few minutes as well. So the Edens, while not being a particularly major aristocratic family in terms of wealth and power, were well connected and certainly well respected within those circles. But Eden had Anton Eden especially had a big problem when he was growing up, and that was that essentially he was not the oldest son, you know, and he was one of four children. I think he was the fourth eldest child, and of course for a minor aristocratic family that meant for that family to survive, all majority of the wealth and land was going to go to the eldest son, and it was for him to then continue that family name. So what we find is that Anton Eden, a lot of his childhood, he spent worrying about what does my future hold? You know, what am I going to do if I'm not going to be the great leader of this family? How do I make my name? And I think he's always kind of struggling in his childhood to try and understand what exactly his future is supposed to be, essentially. And employment is a key theme which runs through a lot of his kind of early life. And it's likely then that actually when the First World War was declared, Eden was probably one of those aristocrats who suddenly jumped at the chance. Actually, here's my chance to prove myself, not only to my family, who probably are looking at me as somebody who's not going to be that useful to them, but also to my class, to my nation. Now, here's a great opportunity for me to prove myself and prove that I deserve credentials, that I can be the kind of great leader that I'm kind of expecting. And when the kind of war was declared, Eden did certainly have that kind of image. There's a few letters kind of written to his mother. He was at Eton at the time when the war was declared. He was still a minor, so he was only 15, 16, so he certainly couldn't join up to the war straight away. But in a letter to his mother on the declaration of war, he said, quite similar to Grenfell actually, in terms of encapsulating the kind of aristocratic ideal of the war, we must all do our share, and the greater the share, the greater the honour if nobly born. You know, he really had that image of this is a noble cause, you know, this is worth fighting for, and we all must kind of do our part for, you know, for king, country, and class. And for Eden especially, he was quite lucky really in his family connections in terms of getting into the military, you know, because the military at the time was still very traditional in his outset. The aristocracy were almost, shortcutted into the roles of kind of officers and captains and commanders simply by the position of their rank and their kind of upbringing. And the way kind of Eden essentially moved into the military, so Anton Eden was a member of the Eden family, of course. His sister, Elfrida Marjorie, had married into the Warwicks. So the early Countess of Warwick, the fifth early Countess of Warwick, she had married their eldest son, Leopold Guy, who would become the future sixth Earl of Warwick. And his sister, Marjorie, then was married to the Earl of Faversham, who was the commander of the kind of newly formed the Yorkshire Rifles at the time. And certainly Eden, of course, based quite up north, you know, was very determined to join this regiment, and through his family connections then was made a staff captain in 1916. As soon as he kind of reached that birth age, he kind of basically abandoned Eton at his first opportunity and went straight into the military. And then from kind of May 1916, he was on the front line and he was sent to fight. He remained in France then pretty much unabated until 1919, until the kind of demobilisation of the army began, serving quite a few infamous battles, the battles of the Somme he was at, Messines Ridge, and the successive battles of the German offensive in kind of mid to late 1918 as well. And he was described, he was considered quite a capable soldier as well. He was described as young but capable, an energetic, cool and resourceful in battle. You know, he was supposedly encapsulated that image of a kind of what the aristocracy would have liked to think of themselves as great leaders of men, and they were born to lead others as well. And kind of Eden's kind of thirst for war and glory and purpose and having something to do really with his life led him to the front line. But hopefully what we'll see from these letters is that as the war goes on and as he kind of, the war becomes very visible to him and he's kind of in the middle of it, that actually the brutalization of battle really leads Eden to kind of abandon that kind of those noble conceptions he has of what the war is in order for him to survive the war and actually try and manage his understanding of what exactly is happening to him there. And really I've been trying to do this through three key areas which seem to have a consistency in Eden's letters throughout the kind of next 3 years. Firstly, his relationship to nature and kind of how he uses the natural world and this, the senses around him to try and understand and express, I guess, you know, how he's feeling and what's happening in the war. But also the kind of proximity he has to violence. How does his kind of proximity to violence impact the way he thinks of the war and the way he thinks of the kind of noble cause? And then his relationship to the home front, really just as a bit of fun, I guess, just to kind of see how Eden thought about politicians, bearing in mind what he would become in the Second World War as well. Also, the letters themselves are written to his sister, Elfrieda Marjorie. He did not have a very close relationship with his parents in one of his later memoirs. So, Another World, again, if anyone wants to have a quick look at this at the end, this is a memoir that Anthony Eden wrote in the 50s about the First World War, about his First World War experience. And it basically says in there, you know, my mother was a drag. You know, she was always on at me. She wouldn't leave me alone. You know, she kept writing to me and I was pretty sick of her. And so he basically tried to sever communication with his parents because he felt quite kind of suffocated, I guess. And so a lot of his kind of outreaches, his kind of outpouring of emotion tended then to fall onto his sister, who was 9 years older than him. She had been quite an inspiration to him, I think, in his childhood. So he writes quite openly to his sister. And of course, as a captain, as an officer, he gets a lot more freedom in terms of censorship than many others who were kind of serving underneath him. So he does kind of pour out quite a lot of emotion into those letters as well. So as I mentioned, one of the kind of key aspects of his letters is this idea of nature and particularly discussions of weather, because weather seems to be the kind of quintessential British talking point, doesn't it? You know, if you don't know what to say to somebody, you talk about the weather to kind of fill conversation. And that certainly is pretty much kind of what Anthony Eden does as well. You know, weather is that kind of small talk. It is that kind of social interaction people have when you're just trying to fill time. And very much so in travel writing, and particularly aristocratic travel writing in the kind of 19th and early 20th centuries. You know, lots of kind of aristocratic letters focus very specifically on the climate, on the weather, on the landscape. And one kind of sense of that, of course, is to try and either the reader, the person you're intending to read this letter, or the group, more likely, that you're intending to read the letter you're sending, is that you're either painting them a picture where you can invite them into your experience, or painting a picture where you're distancing them. You know, it's about kind of managing that relationship with your reader, about how involved you want them to get into your own experience. So really bridging that kind of physical space. For Anthony Eden, as I said, the kind of natural world is this kind of ever-present theme which runs through a lot of his kind of post-war writings. And a lot of people, I mean, Wilfred Owens and Siegfried Sassoon's, a lot of their kind of poems are very heavily focused on the natural world and weather particularly. And there's been some kind of really wonderful works. Like Paul Fussell, I think he wrote a book in the 70s about the natural world and how the war had impacted that relationship with the landscape, with the rural world. And modernism as a whole. And of course Eden himself, as with a lot of the aristocracy, actually functioned within a rural landscape. You know, landscape was the quintessential image they had of their home, living on an 8,000 acre estate and in the countryside. You know, that kind of relationship with the land would have been very specifically quite consistent with them, rather than maybe quite some quite urban populations. Certainly working class communities might not have that same level of engagement. And Eden does talk about weather quite a lot. So in a lot of his letters, the weather essentially takes on a kind of symbolic representation of the war experience for himself. So, you know, when he is talking about the kind of weather, it tends to reflect whether his trench experience is a good experience and he is kind of emboldened by the kind of this idea of a noble cause, or whether he is kind of trying to fight against the noble cause and is expressing that through weather. So, you know, when weather is bad, you know, it's not the kind of weather for kind of warfare. Again, you know, the weather is beastly and so is the war. You know, they tend to come and fall side by side in a lot of his writings. And you can sometimes find clues, you know, when he's maybe trying, doesn't really want to invite his sister into those horrible experiences, he's actually doing that through instead making, emphasising or understating the weather within that. And there's quite a few kind of examples of that. So again, as I said, when Eden possibly has a really bad experience in war, he's on the front line, he's had a terrible battle, he maybe has seen men fall down dead, the weather becomes suddenly very gloomy, very dark, very terrible. And then when he maybe takes a short break away from the line, he's maybe some reserves come in to replace his regiment, suddenly the weather takes a calmer effect on him, and he doesn't necessarily kind of overstate it. So for example here, you know, please excuse this awful scrawl, but he's writing under difficulties. The particular date of this corresponds to his regiment's battles, that they were under heavy shelling at this time from the Germans. And again, you know, the weather comes out quite consistently in this letter. You know, the weather here is beastly, much too much rain, and the rain is the one thing we hate more than the Hun. You know, that weather takes on that kind of representation of this kind of horrible shelling from above that him and his regiment are kind of suffering. And again, very similarly, you know, another kind of very hard battle that his regiment suffered. You know, the weather is odious, raining hard, and I'm very wet, and as I've been for a long ride on duty, not pleasure. And again, that weather reflects this idea of, you know, he's doing his duty, but it's a very bad, you know, he's suddenly not necessarily believing in it anymore, not sure what it's all about, and he's expressing that through this horrible weather that he's enduring as well. And again, another letter in kind of mid-1917, which is, I think, when his regiment suffered the most kind of brutal battles in Messines Ridge particularly, I think. The weather is still perfectly hopeless and shows no sign of improving. It is, of course, perfectly awful for the people in line, but still worse for the Germans. You know, again, this idea of the battle, you know, is not just about this noble cause for Britain, but actually the war itself is a horrendous experience. And again, he's expressing that through the weather that he's seeing. But again, when he steps out of the front line, you know, weather suddenly takes on a bit of a sense of his relationship to the war kind of changes. So, for example, you know, okay, so we're in the trenches again. He just had a short break. It's a fairly quiet time at present. You know, the weather here is very changeable. It's fine one minute, it's wet the next, but it's much better than it was. Again, as he's kind of moving in and out of kind of warfare again, the weather suddenly takes on this symbolic representation of his attitude, his feelings to the war and his feelings to battle, that it is changeable, that, you know, he's fine one moment, but then war starts and it becomes quite brutal again, that he's had a bit of a rest and maybe it's not as bad as he once was, and he's feeling a bit calmer about it. And kind of weather is quite key to his kind of understanding of and expression, I guess, more than anything, of kind of the war experience. And George Mossy, again, has written a pretty fantastic book, actually, I think, on the role of kind of violence and representation of war by soldiers. And essentially argues that the British elite, for them, and in his opinion, that the First World War was actually a literary experience, that, you know, for aristocrats who could write and could write quite frequently, in fact, back home, that you can actually understand that experience from kind of reading letters. But from this, you can see that actually the aristocratic experience was far more than just a written experience. You know, it was a very physical experience. That the weather almost becomes that experience. He's using the weather to try and understand his experience and trying to explain it. And the natural war, therefore, is reflective of that lived experience. You know, the brutalisation of the weather in his letters is really reflective of that kind of brutalisation of the war and the breakdown of that idea of a noble cause and a noble war that he probably would have liked it to have been when he set out. And that kind of follows on, really. So this idea of violence in the war. And it's quite interesting, isn't it, with the First World War, because of course the reality of the First World War was killing. You know, it was death, it was violence, it was bloodshed. You know, today I think when we look back, it's quite comforting for us, I think, and quite settling for us to think of the war as a great sacrifice of people. You know, people sacrificed themselves, they went through enormous suffering for us today, and almost try and kind of whitewash this sense of the brutality, the killing, the death, you know, of that not only British soldiers did and German soldiers, but, you know, everybody essentially on the front line were involved in killing. Joanna Borg wrote a really great book on the experience of killing, where she uses very kind of individual moments as an expression, but essentially says that, you know, we should think of the war as less as a great sacrifice, but also as a great time of killing and of death as well. And what's kind of really interesting about that then is how people then try to manage that experience. You know, if this was a noble cause, how do you align that with this sense of killing and the actual physical act of killing kind of other people? It's quite interesting actually to see this exhibition, of course, because this is one way that was managed. It was that kind of experience of the front line was to essentially create these kind of social movements within the front line. To try and almost distance themselves from that experience as well. And there are a few signs of in Eden's letters that actually when he was him and his regiment were involved in this kind of bloodshed, this violence, this kind of brutalization of the front line, there was this kind of lingering sense of the noble cause kind of sticking throughout. So, you know, in one letter after quite a successful battle for his regiment, I think they moved several miles in one single day. You know, again, in his letter, he's expressing, you know, what a war, you know, it seems to be raging everywhere at once, you know, this kind of great adrenaline rush almost that he's having from war and from victory when he's there. But actually, this is quite rare within his letters, you know, and in actual fact, within his letters, his letter writing really betrays that idea of it being a great heroic, that the kind of violence that he was seeing was heroic and was noble and was important to him and to the cause. And actual fact, his future memoirs, interestingly, so in his memoirs that he wrote in the 50s of the First World War, there's almost no records in there whatsoever of his men and his regiment actually killing Germans, essentially. It's all about the sacrifice that his men suffered, the men he saw die around him, and not the acts that his regiment committed, I guess, and had to do to kind of achieve victory at that time. And there's a few kind of reasons for that. Stephen Goebel, who's a kind of medievalist historian, bizarrely, but actually wrote a book about the First World War, essentially says that the kind of this idea of the noble cause and noble war emboldened men to become kind of great killers. He says the image of the knight, of course, kind of almost sanctified bloodletting on quite a kind of catalytic level on the front line, and kind of justified, you know, killing indiscriminately. If you were just killing on the front line, that was fine, you know, as long as you weren't killing you know, with vengeance and with anger, you know, then that was a problem. But as long as you were killing and just killing for the noble cause, you know, that was okay. But that doesn't really help us really with the kind of how did members of the aristocracy specifically, but others kind of manage that experience then of killing kind of psychologically. And there's a few ways kind of Eden kind of does this. And really when he begins on the front line, you see a lot of, in his writings, Eden, when kind of explaining violence and death and brutality of war, almost resorting to kind of childish whims, to try and think of it in a kind of childish mind, with quite simplistic kind of undertones. So when kind of looking at you know, a great battle that's taking place, you know, again he refers to the great offensive as a show. You know, this is a pantomime almost. You know, splendid. I thoroughly enjoyed it, contrary to expectations. You know, again, that idea of dying on the front line is simply something. You know, if all goes well with me and Hun is kind to me, as he keeps being kind to me, you know, I'm not dead yet, you know, then I'll be able to get my leave. You know, there's quite a kind of almost kind of innocence and naivety in his writings, which he's kind of expressing. But then also around Christmas time, you know, again, a very heavy bombardment that he suffers at Christmas. You know, again, he kind of writes in here, you know, I think the Boche must be having a joy day. You know, he's giving us quite an unnecessary number of Christmas presents, you know, this morning. You know, and then throughout the letter, you know, you can imagine him writing there, writing this letter, and actually these kind of shells going on for Anna, because, you know, in that letter he's, oh, here's another Christmas present. Oh, here's another Christmas present. You know, the Boche is in a very generous mood today. And kind of almost reducing, you know, this this experience to almost as like a childhood game almost, that's kind of happening around him. And again, you know, when kind of talking about kind of his role, his first kind of duty on the front line, you know, he's quite enjoying being a bombing officer. You know, as, you know, one can then strafe whenever the fancy one takes it. It's almost having this, I can just kind of do what I want. You know, it's just a game. I'm just going to be playing around. And I said, resorting to those kind of childhood fantasies of war when he begins. But as the war goes on then, his kind of relationship then to that experience does begin to change. And to begin with, it begins to change depending on the kind of proximity he has to violence. So it seems like the closer he is to violence, the more kind of brutal his understanding of the war becomes. And again, the further away from violence he is, the more kind of simplistic it is. Quite naturally. So again, in some of his letters, you know, when he is quite distant and he's thinking of, you know, this great battle, maybe that, you know, his regiment are bombing from afar, he essentially is looking at it almost in that kind of aristocratic hunting terms. You know, this idea of you know, we're hunting down you know, the Hun. It was very interesting chasing the Hun once we had broken the main line of resistance. You know, there are lots of civilians, they're hanging out flags and they're delighted to see us, almost like this hunting party kind of image that he's kind of trying to put across to his sister about these kind of brutal acts. And again, you know, in another respect, personally, I think the Hun shooting will be over before the Grabs shooting begins. You know, it's taking that kind of brutality and almost kind of sanitizing it into this kind of aristocratic play and pastime as well. But of course, the problem with this and the problem with these kind of hunting kind of metaphors is that, unlike in hunting, where, you know, these men will be on horses chasing down foxes or whatever, the fox is not going to turn around and start chasing them. Where, of course, on the front line, you know, the German is shooting back, and the German could turn around and suddenly come straight back. And when that happens, it's then when you see Eden begin to completely kind of abandon that this idea of this noble cause, this kind of aristocratic playtime that he likes to believe. And so you kind of then get these kind of quite brutal messages. So again, you know, in this letter, it's a very short letter that he's writing to his sister, and he's talking about, you know, we've killed an enormous number of Huns. You know, we're very tired as a result. You know, almost like, you know, how dare they make me waste all my energy having to kill them. Even more significantly, you know, again, you know, this is a really horrible war. You know, there's a burst of shells. You know, I should be glad when I never have to hear, you know, the beastly shrills of shrieks or see another burst of shells when they're kind of coming down around him. And probably most prominently, I think, in his letters, this one letter, I think, it takes place at a time where I think his regiment are effectively face to face with another German regiment. And while within this letter he doesn't talk about them actually physically killing other Germans, I think when you read it, you can very easily see that is very much the case when they're here. So when he's talking about you know, this area they've just kind of taken over, you know, he's never realised before that the German was such an unsanitary brute. You know, I should have thought that his military efficiency could have made him, you know, sanitary, but not a bit of it. You know, you've never seen anything as disgusting. You know, they're particularly unpleasant sort of fly bats, sluggish and sticky. Quite animalistic, you know, quite kind of almost that kind of Nazi image that they had of, you know, people that they didn't necessarily agree with. Now, that's kind of the conception Eden has taken here of the Germans. What's quite interesting about this, I haven't highlighted them here, but in the bottom section here, he's also talking about German prisoners that they captured some, or were going to capture some German prisoners that had surrendered. But in his letter, he makes some quite subtle hints and suggestions about what actually happened. Because in it, he says, you know, so they fought very well, as treacherously as any Huns I've known. I only heard of one lot surrendering when they poked at their arms and shot our fellows in the back at first opportunity. Of course, we did not want many prisoners after that, you know. And I think what he's essentially saying here is that perhaps, you know, a German regiment were going to surrender or were not surrendering. And of course, then they were very determined not to take prisoners. And it's likely then that, you know, they probably killed lots of Germans who may have wanted to surrender at this time. And Eden then is trying to manage that kind of that experience of killing others, probably up close and personal, by resorting to these quite kind of vindictive, aggressive, brutalistic terms to try and manage that experience. You know, there is absolutely nothing noble really in what he's writing here at all. He's completely abandoning that sense of it being a just cause and this is for king and country. You know, this is very personal and very kind of aggressive in his tone. So as I said, you kind of get this real sense that in his writings, the closer he is to Wagner, I mean, it's very simple, you know, and it's very, you know, it's not a great revelation really, but the closer he is to violence, the more kind of the noble war is abandoned and forgotten. You know, the proximity to violence really determines how this noble cause survives within the kind of mindset of the aristocracy. But then Eden did also have a relationship, of course, with the home fronts, and particularly those back home. And it's quite common, I mean, that, you know, anybody who's read letters from the First World War, from any kind of class, whether working, middle or upper classes, will know that there was quite a lot of resentment from the front line of those back home, you know, whether it was men, women or children that they're writing to, particularly the press and politicians, about, you know, they don't know what we're going through, essentially. You know, we know best because we're on the front line. But what's quite interesting, of course, is that, you know, Eden, as a member of the aristocracy, as a member of that establishment, you know, of politicians and the press and the wealthy, does start to kind of embody that as well. And of course, it was expected this kind of noblesse oblige, this kind of duty that the aristocracy had to their country would kind of drive them through, that they would be kind of completely selfless, you know, they wouldn't worry about problems, they would just go on fighting for the noble cause, for king and country. And again, in Eden's writings, you can kind of show signs of that slipping in his partial resentment to the established order back home that he's kind of showing. So what you kind of see in here is, and again, this is kind of more just for, you know, a bit of fun, considering Anti-Eden would become one of these great war politicians, you know, but again, you know, the House of Commons, they seem to be completely out of touch with the war. Than ever, you know, they seem to be the last people in the whole country to realise that this is the final struggle and that the fate of even their own beastly skins hangs on this result. I think this was at the time when the government, Lloyd George, were looking for peace terms with the Germans in the kind of early 1918, and Eden, again, you know, wanted to continue fighting throughout the war. Again, probably even more vindictive, probably the most kind of brutal that I think Anti-Eden could possibly be. You know, Lloyd George has made a very stupid speech in the House, I see. I wish they would muzzle or drown or murder all these infernal politicians until after the war. I don't know why we should be telling the Germans that they won this battle. You know, they didn't, they lost very heavily indeed. You know, trying to depress the country won't help you win the war. And a Prime Minister who makes a speech like this doesn't deserve to retain his position. Which is interesting, of course, based on 30 years later that he would be that politician, the other side of it. But again, there is a lot of resentment in Anti-Eden from the front line towards the kind of politicians back home, this established order of which he is supposed to be nobly fighting for, and kind of really takes a kind of quite kind of vindictive mindset back towards them as well. The press, of course, naturally took quite a big hitting from Anti-Eden as well, so, you know, he blames the press for the kind of negative feelings back home about the war. So it's, you know, it's only the beasts and papers that talk such rot. I'm sure we've only got to stick it another year, and then we'll have the Germans beaten. You know, we need more men. You know, he's very determined that it is the press who are the bad ones. Particularly, you know, people back home, they sure ought to be very pleased. But I hear there's still a few people who do nothing but grouse and criticise, and most of the papers are such hopeless rags nowadays as well. Sounds quite familiar, I think, doesn't it, to some of us today? And then, of course, you know, again, what's quite interesting is Anti-Eden's then relationship with other groups within the British Army. Of course, it was not just the aristocracy fighting, but working class people and more significantly, colonials as well. And again, you know, Eden is quite vindictive towards a lot of the minorities within the British Army. You know, it's disgusting that, as usual, you know, all the credit seems to go to the Irish and the colonials, and none to us wretched English. You know, it annoys me very much, and of course they did well, but no better than anyone else. You know, he's a lot of his writings, and again, I haven't put them on here, up on here, but again, there's a lot of a lot of letters where he's saying, "Oh, those stupid Canadians are messing things up for us." You know, the Italians are useless. The Russians, whatever. You know, they're completely folded. You know, again, a lot of resentment to other groups, and you know, almost kind of falling into that kind of trench culture, which was quite established at the time of the, you know, the kind of "I'm here and now" and this kind of eyewitness identity that they have. Again, abandoning that idea of this is a noble cause. I'm here selflessly, you know, performing my duties to king and country. But taking quite a very vindictive tone even towards a lot of his own men and those around him and above him as well. So for Anton Eden then, for me, I think it's a really complicated chap, I think, in the First World War. You know, he you can see that he's really struggling with what exactly he's doing there. You know, he went there to prove himself, to prove his duty to his king and country, to kind of as his kind of letter to his mother showed, you know, to kind of do his duty, you know, and he, you know, have, you know, earn some honour and, you know, perform his duty, which is nobly born. But that kind of experience of the front line really begins to break down that idea of a noble cause. And for me, Anton Eden, actually, his survival on the front line was based on him breaking that identity of a noble cause, and his survival was. Essentially, for him to survive, you know, he kind of almost had to take on this persona of this kind of resentment, you know, brutality, violence, in order to survive. And you kind of see that coming through his letters to his sister about how he's trying to manage that experience quite significantly. But certainly, kind of what comes after the war, then. So, you know, Anton Eden did fight. You know, the armistice was then declared, The really, I said they're quite complicated. The really funny thing about Anton Eden is that almost as soon as the war is over, his image of the war completely changes, So he kind of readapts this image of a noble war as soon as the armistice is signed. So in letters to his mother, written in 1919, you know, he kind of talks about the post-war war as being depressed, miserable and bored. You know, if it goes on much longer than this, you know, I'll go completely mad. The demobilization process was deadly dull, while the trenches were, you know, suddenly those very exciting times. You know, he kind of has that that kind of trench fever where, you know, he's kind of almost this experience had been so exciting and so full on and really dominated his mind and his body and soul that as soon as it was over, suddenly it became this great noble cause again. You know, it was suddenly the great thing that him and his men had done. And kind of really, as I said, he really kind of shifted himself back within that paradigm of a noble cause, the sacrifice, the self-sacrifice of the men who were there on the front line. Eden did continue forward, you know, with quite an aristocratic living as well. A lot of people tend to, there's a few historians which say that Eden had a particularly good war. You know, they say he had a good war because he almost didn't break that kind of aristocratic tradition as he moved out of the First World War. You know, he went to Oxford University, studied languages. By 1923, then he stood in a general election. So this is Eden using his family connections quite well. So in 1923, he stood for Warwick and Leamington through the connection with his sister, who by this point was the Countess of Warwick. It was quite a bitter affair, though, the 1923 election, because he stood against his sister's mother-in-law, Daisy, who was the Dowager Countess of Warwick, who had kind of thrown all her weight and wealth into the Labour Party and the Labour movement, and had become. She was the first woman to stand for the Labour Party, but it was, of course, absolutely derided as being an aristocrat who was standing for a socialist movement. You know, she was kind of nicknamed the Champagne Socialist as well, because she would still ride around in a carriage and horse-drawn cart while campaigning for the dissolution of the estates and the rise of the working classes. It was quite brutal, in fact. And Anton Eden, it's quite interesting what was mentioned at the beginning, because the Earl of Warwick put forward Anton Eden for the election, and one of the reasons, which is quite humorous that he did that, is in 1918, of course, middle and some working class women had been granted the vote for the first time, you know, and women could suddenly vote in elections. And for the Earl of Warwick thought, well, how are we going to start winning votes for women let's get the most attractive men we can. And it was actually that reason that Anthony Eden was put forward in 1923 for the Conservative Party, because the Earl thought he was quite dashing and that therefore he'd get all the female votes over Daisy. Which did work, actually. Maybe not for that reason, but he certainly did. He was victorious in that election, 1923, and of course then his career completely expanded from there. Once he was in Parliament, he just continued rolling forward. As I said, he wasn't too fond of Daisy. This is a note from his diary where he essentially calls Daisy a heartless ass because she was not very... He just didn't like her very much, I think, so he was quite brutal as well, even to her. And of course, by the 1930s then, he had risen to the role of Foreign Secretary, became quite renowned for resigning against the appeasement to Mussolini's Italy, I believe, in kind of 36. And then stood as kind of Churchill's right-hand man for the kind of next 15 to 20 years throughout the Second World War, up to the 50s, where it all tumbled apart with the kind of the Suez Crisis. And he's kind of really considered Eden, isn't he, to kind of be that kind of last kind of politician who kind of stood to defend the empire, you know, the man who stood for tradition and the kind of last kind of aristocratic leader to try fight to retain the empire and the traditional order in a world where really it was just not going to be possible anymore. And the United States made it quite clear to him that wasn't going to be the case. It's quite a shame, really, because Eden, if you ever look through kind of voting patterns of the when people vote, you know, who's the greatest politician of the 20th century, the greatest prime minister, Eden always comes last, sadly. He's always at the bottom of the pile, largely because of Suez, you know, that kind of incident quite particularly kind of changed it before, you know, his successor Macmillan's kind of Winds of Change speech, and suddenly he's the great hero of the 20th century as a result. But for me, Eden, as I said, when people look at the First World War, it's very easy to look for what came next. You know, how, you know, the clues in the First World War to kind of show us how he got to Suez, how he fought and led, you know, with Churchill in the Second World War. But for me, the kind of real significance, the reason this is quite interesting to me, is actually that kind of role and identity the aristocracy had in the First World War. You know, what exactly was their position? You know, country house exhibitions, you know, the reenactment groups as well, and any portraits. I mean, you know, there's so many portraits published of these kind of great men, whether they were dead or alive, after the Second World War, of the First World War, of aristocrats. They are seen as heroic victims, you know, these men who did believe in noblesse oblige, that led a noble cause in the war and lost their lives for it, you know. But as I said, hopefully from kind of Eden's letters, must be the case, I'm sure, with many other kind of aristocratic writings, is there is a sense that survival on the front line, you know, there may have been some who did survive with keeping that noble cause throughout, but for kind of individual like Eden, kind of abandoning that identity was crucial to his survival as well. And I think, yeah, so that kind of sense of abandoning that kind of morality, that spirituality, and that noble cause was quite important to the aristocracy, and really changed that relationship then the aristocracy had with society, with culture, with the establishment in the 2030s and beyond.
For more information on this podcast, please visit postalheritage.org.uk/podcast.